The problem-solving sessions, I'm hoping, will be more of a informal discussion. I hope to be able to answer your questions. I'm treating this as though we were in a small classroom and we could have a better give and take than we can. So I want to be able to answer your questions. I've actually had one of the students come up and bring me one of the website problems that we can work through and talk through. I'll do that in a little bit. What I want to do first, but I do have the advantage here, is I can play with some of the toys. And so we can have some of our discussion based on looking at actual pieces of equipment and some of the demonstrations we've got here. So I'm gonna start out by asking some PRS kind of questions in just a minute. I want to review through a couple of ideas before we do that. And then we're actually working through some problems that I wanted to look at. First of all, I guess the thing we do is remind ourselves about capacitance. That was the last set of ideas that we talked about last class period. If you have a pair of plates, conducting plates, that you connect to a battery, the battery is a source of voltage, so that's it. It creates a electric potential that will attract the charges to those two plates. And depending on how large a potential you place there, you're going to create larger or smaller amounts of charge on those plates. And the next slide tells you some of the parameters of what causes capacitance and causes capacitance to change. But generally speaking, you can obviously, it's always dependent on the voltage, how much charge can be placed on those. It depends on the voltage is present, but also dependent on the configuration of capacitance. We talked about the fact that the unit of capacitance is called the farad, which is equivalent to 1 coulomb per volt. You see that charge is coulombs, voltage or potentials are in volts, so that's the appropriate unit. If we go to the next slide, we remember that there's two things that can control whether how much charge can be placed on that have to do with how close the plates are to each other, how large the plates are, so that the capacitance is a constant. That constant happens to be what we call the permittivity of free space, times the area of the plates divided by the distance they're between them. So I can take the plates and move them closer together, further apart, change their capacitance. I can add a second pair of plates that therefore increases the relative area of the plates, and that's going to change the capacitance. And then we talked about the idea at the very end that if you actually put the slides up here, if you put a dielectric, a plastic, or some non-conductor in between the plates, it's going to change the capacitance. Generally speaking, this always increases the capacitance because the dielectric makes the pair of capacitor plates act like they're much closer together than they actually are. And so this equation, capacitance is based on the dielectric constant of what's in between the two plates, the area, and the separation. So there's several ways. If you want to change the capacitance, you can change the area. You can change you can place a dielectric between them. You can a lot of different things. Now, you remember, if I went back to that very first slide that I showed you just a few minutes ago, that if I change the capacitance, I'm going to change either the charge or the voltage. And there's some ways that I can control. If capacitance is charge divided by voltage, capacitance is Q divided by V, if I can force one of those to be constant, then I can force the other one to change. Now I guess the easiest thing to do is to ask a question and see if we can visualize what's happening. Ooh, is that right? Can't do that yet, quite yet. Great. Yeah, that's a good question.
that just a second.
But let's, what we're doing then, we'll wait for that to come up. Let's actually put that question up so you can see what the question says. And in a second, it'll bring me up the actual question so you can answer. Okay, we got a parallel plate capacitor. Well, you want to think about and visualize what's happening there. You got a parallel plate capacitor that's attached to a battery. So that battery is going to put a constant potential V. There's our TRS. Now it looks like the class, if you're going to join it, is C. And in a second, I'll actually start the timer. But let's look at it. We have a battery. So the battery connects to both sides of the plate. So it deposits charge on the plate. Then the battery is disconnected, and we take a glass slab, which is a dielectric, and we put that in between the plates. We want to visualize what's going to happen to the voltage between those plates when we put that glass slab in there. So we can make a connection between several pieces of information, you know. A little over a minute. Start out. Now you notice a couple things that happen here. First, you have the bulb disconnected, and then you completely disconnect the plates from the voltage source and see what happens when you now vary the plates.
On the other hand, when you've got the
capacitor connected to the battery. So the voltage is going to be constant if it's held to the battery. So in one case where it's disconnected, the charge is constant. In the other case where the voltage is connected, where the voltage soars, the battery is connected, you know that you can hold that voltage constant. So now when you go in and change the capacitance in some way, that you're going to force whichever the unfixed parameter is going to be. So let's look at it. If we know that Q is equal to C times V, and so let's write it down in terms of this, is equal to K epsilon naught A over D times V. The case that we've got on our problem is that the charge is held constant. So this number is constant, and when we insert the glass plate, we've changed kappa. We've changed kappa from 1, which is an air in the gap, to a kappa of 5 or 10 or whatever the dielectric constant of the plates are. Because this is constant, and because that has just gone up, by definition, the voltage must go down to compensate, so that the totality of that side of the equation is equal to the constant on the other side of the equation. You see how that works?
You said when you put the glass in, that's what changed kappa.
That's what changed kappa. That's right. Because before you put the glass plate in, the kappa, meaning the dielectric constant, that's what kappa is, of the material that's between the plates is the dielectric constant of air, because that's what was there before. And then the dielectric constant of air is 1. The dielectric constant of everything except for air is always going to be greater than 1. So it's always going to increase kappa by placing something in the gap. Okay. Now I'm not going to change what's on the screen here, but let's do the same question, but now don't disconnect the voltage. So let's say it's not disconnected. So everything in the question is the same, except for now we've left the battery connected. Let's ask that same question again. So here is clickers out here. Change it on the PowerPoint, but the question that's now being asked is, what happens if the battery is still connected? Charge to keep the voltage constant. So, yes, the charge now changes, the voltage clearly stays the same. In fact, answer this one ends up being two. I asked you the easy question. I was going to ask the next question, but it's probably easier if I just kind of walk through an explanation of that what's going to change and what's going to stay constant. Let's ask a little bit different question. We want to see if we're trying now, hopefully, for Friday's test, to think through some of the ideas that we've looked at so far. So, I've still got the questions up here. I'm going to show you a video. It's a fun video. I'll show you the video, and then we'll come back to it. So let's project DC here. And I've actually got tubes. I'll give you the description. I'll come and put this back up on the board again. I've got a conducting balloon. It's floating near a highly charged Van de Graaff generator. And we want to visualize what's happening. So I'm gonna step out of that for a second and show you a video of this actual thing happening. Here's our helium-filled conducting balloon. And here's our friend, and let's just expand that so we can see a little bit better. The balloon is bouncing all over the place. Now, we know that the Van de Graaff generator, that's the sphere above that blue box, is highly charged. It's got tons of excess electrons on the ball at the top of it. Let's stop that for a second. Let's go back over, pop back out of that and go back for a question. I go in here, that's not what I want to do. Go in here and ask our question. What's happening to that balloon? Do we understand it? So I didn't write quite as imaginative of options here, but hopefully we've thought. Think about what was happening. That balloon was bouncing back and forth and moving all over the place. Why was it doing it, and what was happening there? Maybe we can think about that and talk about it a little bit once we answer the question on the PRS. SPL, sorry, charged, highly charged in the generator. Looks like, what's the answer? Looks like two's the one that everybody wants to answer. The charge of the balloon changes every time you touch something, either discharging or any excess electrons. And that's really what's happening. We'll go back to that in a second, but let me put up two things here. Here's our Van de Graaff generator. So the generator's right here. Here's the balloon. Okay, the generator is highly charged with negative charges, so that the guy who's standing here he's grounded. Overall, his total charge on his body is zero, because he's standing on the ground and current can flow from the ground to him. But he's an insulator for the most part, so that means that a small positive charge can build up on the side that's nearest. The negative charge is here. What that means? And the same thing is going to happen on the balloon. The balloon is going to build up charges like this. It'll be attracted to this charge. As soon as it gets attracted to this charge and touches it, oops, whatever. Lights go down. set the mood here for our physics class. As soon as it touches, it builds up a huge excess negative charge, which will force it to fly over on the other side. When it touches him, it'll discharge that excess negative charge, and it'll fly back. So it bounces back. It oscillates back and forth between him and the charge. Let's go and look and see that happen. I'll go and put the balloon back up again. You should see the balloon bouncing back and forth. The reason I want sound is for the next part that's right after this. It's that there's another setup that does exactly the same thing. But why am I getting? Yeah. They show another demonstration that's very similar to it. They've got a set of chimes. These are actually little bells. And when they zoom into it, they'll show that it does the same thing. It turns out that two of the chimes are insulated from ground. One of them is held at ground potential. And between them are very tiny little metal balls hanging on chains. I don't know if you can, you obviously can't hear it. I don't know why the sound's not working. But it actually makes the chimes sound. They ding, 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 as they bounce, as that ball bounces back and forth between the grounded and the highly charged. And it turns out that the charge here is building up negative charge on one side because the positive charge is being attracted to the other side closer to the Van de Graaff generator. So that you see exactly that same kind of process. That charge is pulled from one place to another because of the electrostatic forces that are present there, and because of the fact that you can polarize reasonably large charges. Very nothing objects. Okay. Let's go back to our PowerPoint. I've got one last one that I want to let you visualize. I'll put this on the screen so you can see it. Here I've got a set of conducting spheres. Actually, they're not all spheres. One of them's kind of oblong shape. The spheres on the outside are grounded, which means that they are ground potential. Why doesn't it stay next to it? As soon as it touches say it's coming up next to the Van de Graaff. Comes up, touches the Van de Graaff, it instantaneously, because it's a conducting surface as well, it will take some of the charge that's on the Van de Graaff and now have that same charge on it. So now the Van de Graaff is negatively charged. It's also negatively charged. It wants to repel and so it flies away. Good question.
Why do you have to touch the ball with the rod before it starts bouncing?
Oh, it turns out, why does he do that in the demonstration? He's simply grounding everything. He's making sure that when you start out or when you end, that there's no excess electrostatic charge on it. Good question.
Why does, when you get putting the thing up, the generator, the chimes, they stop.
What he does at the very end or the beginning and the end, he goes up and he has the rod that he's carrying is grounded. He goes up and touches the electrostatic generator so that it starts out grounded. Because as soon as he turns it on or turns it off, when he turns it off, he wants all the excess charge to leak away immediately, rather than to be left on there. I don't know if you've walked up to a Van de Graaff generator or walked up to something that's charged and touched it. I go and visit my I got some family members that live over in one of the gated communities here in town, and I drive up to visit them, and I have to key the number into a keypad so the gate will open so I can get in. I'm sitting in the car, I drive up the keypad, touch it, and it gives me a horrible shock. Why does it give me the shock? Because I'm sitting in a car that has wheels that are insulators, or at least reasonably good insulators. The rubber is an insulator. So it means as I'm just going along, driving along, my car builds up a little bit of excess static electricity. It builds up a little bit of charge. And when I touch something that's metal, that's grounded, I'm now discharging that to ground. And all of the excess charge in my car is now being discharged through my finger to that keypad. Usually I've learned that I go and touch the back of my hand rather than the end of my finger, so it's not quite as localized where it hurts, but it'll hurt. It'll say, well. But that idea, now you don't notice that very much in Florida because we've got enough humidity and the water molecules in the air will carry and discharge static electricity very easily. If you live in the north or in the mountain west, where it's very, very dry in the winter, you walk across the floor and scuff your feet and walk up to your friend, touch him on the nose, and shock him. You don't know, it's a practical joke that you can't do in Florida, because if you touch him on the nose, they'll go, what are you doing? But if you touch him on the nose, he'll shock, you can give him a freaking shock if it's really dry, because you can build up static electricity by scuffing your feet on the carpet. The idea of excess charge is an important one. Now we're gonna look at a different one. Here I've got three balls. In fact, you can see the three balls, they're actually right here. Two perfect spheres, one that's kind of an oblong shape, and I wanna ask a question about what's happening there. Excess charge wants to move as far away from other like charges as possible. So there's some possibilities of what's going to happen to this particular charge. Now, the center one is going to be connected to a Van de Graaff dinner. So I'm going to build up large excess negative charge on that central one. What's going to do? What is it going to do? Is it going to discharge to one side or the other side? Is it going to discharge to both sides equally? Think about what's going to happen because of what I say in the question. And then we'll actually look at it and see what it actually does. And this configuration, oops, well, turn back on. I don't know why the battery in this thing turns it off there pretty quick. But this is the exact configuration right here that we're going to look at. So, is everybody in there? I saw there was about 20 people left and to answer. And we're getting in the last few seconds, so come on. Last 8 to 10 of you can give a guesstimate on what our answer is going to be before we start. Okay. So what are our answers? Let's see. It looks like 3, 4, and 5 are possibilities. 3, 4, and 5. It looks like my red herrings of 1 and 2 didn't do any good. The one on the right, it's going to discharge the one on the right because it's closer. The one on the left is closer. I guess that's not going to happen. But I get almost equal answers on the other three. Now, let's actually see what happens. But I guess the easiest way to do that. Eventually it will discharge. It is assuming that it actually is grounded. I can feel it. It should discharge eventually. the other, there's an answer six, none of the above, again. Wonder if it's just, I wonder if in the wet air, it's just not, I can hear it crying, let me, I should discharge it, but I won't.
I'll move these two close to the fire. Just a little bit.
Sorry if I'm in the way so you can't see it. I'm against. I had them so they're all exactly, they were both exactly that far away. I'm trying to make them so they're closer. So we do have pretty wet air in the room, so. I'm not sure how well it's going to discharge. It was discharging yesterday afternoon very well. Well, there we go. It's discharging to the one on the right. It's a little bit better than the one on the left, although the discharge isn't really consistent. There we go. To build up the voltage, it'll. We made a measurement of the distances. The distances are almost identical on each side. The distance from the ball on the right and the ball on the left are almost identical, but it almost always discharges to the one on the right. Why? And your answer was correct for those who put it down. It's discharging to the one on the right because of shape. Why is that shape something that's going to make a difference? That's right. You've got to put closer to a corner on that one than any place else. So it's as far from the rest of the charge as anything else. So that any charges that get out to that edge, after that point, are going to be easier to leave the surface of that nodule that sticks out to the side than any place else on the surface. And again, the fact that it's not discharging more is actually surprising to me. If I can bring it, so I guess it's that much closer. I can get it so that it'll discharge to the other one, but not very well. I guess I don't think I can get it much closer than this. That's surprising how close you have to get them to actually get it to discharge today. The wet air in the room, I think it has a lot to do with it. The humidity is much higher today than we've got it in most days. But there's another idea of the electrostatics that we've been talking about and trying to understand. So that's an important concept that we wanted to make sure we covered. We spend the rest of the time kind of working through problems. And I've chosen three problems, one that was handed to me by a student. Oops, that's not the set. The first one I'm going to solve is one of them that's actually one of your recitation problems, and hopefully my handwriting is a little bit better when I do it this way. Okay. Let's start out with problem 35. So here's our problem 35. Let's see what it says. Says two point charges, Q1 and Q2, are separated by a distance L. The electric potential is zero at point A, which is a distance L over 4 from Q1. What is the ratio of Q1 and Q2? And I actually tried to not do a great job, but reproduce the actual picture in the book. So here's Q1 at what we call the origin at point 0, 0. Point Q2, charge Q2 is a distance L away from it, and point A, which is where we're going to make our, where we know that the potential is zero, is L over 4 away from that one. So I start out by writing down my principle. What physics is it that's going to help me solve the problem? And it says that potentials add as scalars. They don't add as vectors, they add as scalars, which actually is an advantage. And that positive potentials are going to be found around a positive charge. Negative potentials are going to be found around a negative charge. So a negative charge creates a negative potential. A positive charge creates a positive potential. Now, we've said that at some point between those two, you've got zero potential. Before I start working the problem, I already know something about the potential, right? I know that because we have to add two potentials together to equal zero, one of them has to be negative, and one of them has to be positive. That means that one of the charges has to be negative, and one of the charges has to be positive. Let's see what our solution to the problem tells us. Now, I didn't draw another diagram, although normally I would draw some kind of diagram for the problem. I'm going to write down my knowns and unknowns. Well, I know that the distance from charge Q1 to point A is L over 4. And also, because I'm along that same line, that if I would have measured the distance from charge Q2 to that point, it would be the length L minus L over 4, or 3/4 L. So R1 is L over 4, R2 is 3/4 of L. The unknown, the thing that they're asking us to solve, I write down as my question mark, is equal to the ratio between the two charges. They're not asking you for position. They're not asking you for... They could ask you a lot of different things about the problem, but what they're specifically asking you is, they don't give you either of the charges, but they do want you to find their ratio. And I've had a few students email me or ask me, they said, but they don't give us either one of the charges. How can I find their ratio? Well, let's see if we can do that. Those first steps are really what I would call W in my Weiss method. The next step is I want to isolate the unknown. I want to take an equation, and I'll use the defining equation for the potential around a point charge, and I'll say, okay, I know that I can add two potentials together to get a total potential, and I know that at point A, that it's going to be equal to zero. So I've got something I can work with. I've got to do a little bit of algebra to solve this problem. And so what I'll do is I'll take, okay, V total is going to be the sum of two voltages. Well, I can use that equation and plug it in each place, where V1 is the one that's caused by voltage 1, and you're measuring at a distance R1 away. The other one is charge Q2, and it's you're measuring at a distance R2 away. And we know that that's equal to 0. So 0 is equal to, now let's see what we've got. Q1, well, I've actually used the lowercase q's because that's what we've got given us to as the problem. R1 is L over 4. That's the distance we are from charge 1. Minus sign, that's a plus sign. Charge Q2 over 3/4 L. Well, 3/4 L is R2. So now I can take those equations. Well, it turns out the 3/4 you can put the 4 up on top. The 1/4, you can put the 4 up on top. So you can actually rewrite the equation we had over here. Again, right here is 4k q1 over L, or 4k q2 over 3L. And they're added together, right? Now let's go one more step. The next step is there's a lot of constants that are the same in each one of them. So I can cancel out the 4s. I can cancel out the k's. I can cancel out the L's. The only thing that's left behind in this first one is Q1. The only thing that's left behind in the second one is Q2 over 3. Just a little bit of algebra brings us down to the point that if I take Q1 and move it over to the other side, I have to put a minus sign on it to subtract it and move it over to the other side. And then if I divide by Q2, I end up with the ratio of Q1 to Q2 is equal to 1/3. I've done that, and you notice there are no constants in there. There's just a number. That's all that's left. All the constants that were in there before, I canceled out from the step before. And so do you actually need to plug in numbers for any of those knowns or that you've got in the problem? Well, actually, no, you don't. You've actually already done that. Let's evaluate it, see what we get. The only way a positive and negative potential can be created is if you have add a negative potential and a positive potential. They have to add to equal zero, and so is if one is caused by a negative charge. One caused by a negative charge, one caused by a positive charge. The fact that the ratio between the two is a negative number says that one is negative. And the fact that charge Q2 is three times as far away means it can get away with being only one-third as, it has to be three times as large to give the same potential. So again, once I evaluate it, I see that my number, both the sign and the magnitude are reasonable. The fact that I've got a pure number, that there's no constants in there at all, or that there are no units in there, actually also is reasonable. So that's a good evaluation. And you see that I've gone through the steps of the Weiss method to solve that effectively. Let me look at a different problem. This one is one, actually I'm going backward, or a little bit earlier in the same chapter. This happens to be problem 17. It's not the problem 18 that I had you do, but it's one that shows another idea that I think is important to try and look at. Here's the question. It says an electron is moving from an initial location where the potential is Vi is 30 volts to a final location where Vf is 150 volts. What is the change in electron's potential energy? One of the things that I want you to remember and be very careful about is that you've got two different concepts that use almost the same words, but they mean very different things. Potential energy and potential. Potential is voltage. It is it's an electric concept that doesn't have an analog anywhere else. Potential energy, on the other hand, is energy caused by position. It's the concept that we've seen for, since the early last semester. We learned about it in 2053. Potential energy, kinetic energy, work, heat, they're all forms of energy. The word potential in potential energy has a very different meaning than the potential of a voltage potential. And it's just an unhappy coincidence that they happen to be the same word. They don't mean the same thing at all. We're looking for potential energy here. But they are connected. The potential, the voltage times the charge is going to give you the potential energy, at least in the electric case. So there is a connection, but they are not the same thing. They're not the same concept, and we need to work to deal with that. Okay, the knowns. Well, there's several knowns in the problem. We actually know that because it's an electron that's moving, we know what its charge is. We know that the charge is a negative charge, and we know that it's equal to 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. So that's a known. It's not stated in the problem other than the fact that the charge is an electron. So we have to go and look up what the value is, but it's a known quantity because it's given, because we're told that it's an electron. We're given the initial voltage, we're given the final voltage, the initial and final potentials. Not potential energies. And what the unknown is the change in potential energy. So delta PE is our question mark. That's the unknown. And because we always write, if we write something that's as a delta, it's always the final potential energy minus the initial potential energy is really the unknown that we're going to see. And that actually sets up the equation that we're going to have to use to solve the problem. So again, here's a kind of a diagram of what's happening. We start out maybe it's right next to a pair of capacitor plates, maybe it's right next to a pair of charges that create potentials. We don't know what the origin of the different potentials are, but it moves from a place where it's plus 30 volts to a place where it's plus 150 volts. And it's an electron that's going to move from one place to another. So I've drawn just a very, very simple schematic diagram. Now, if I'm going to isolate my unknown, the very first thing I want to do is choose a valid equation to give you a hint for the test when you're solving them on the test. We will post on the board for you a list of equations, and usually they're the equations that are listed in the summary at the end of the chapter. Those are the equations you will almost always want to start your problem solving with. You don't want to start, I treat equations in a couple of different, very different classes. If an equation is a fundamental equation, it's one that we've used in the calculations, that we've started out with as, you know, something like this is a defining equation. Sometimes you'll get something that is a derived equation. We'll start with an equation and we'll rearrange it and put it into a form that we can solve for a specific unknown. And usually we will never want to start with what I call a derived equation. We want to start with a fundamental equation. So here's one that's a fundamental equation, and voltage is defined as potential energy divided by charge. And I've actually chosen an equation in the format that it's written at the end of the chapter. Okay, now we're going to need to do a little algebra because we want to find the change in potential energy. That's this value. But it turns out I can rearrange this equation so that potential energy, electric potential energy, is equal to charge times voltage. Now, I've had to rearrange it from my original form already, but I started out with a form that's the one that the textbook uses. So now what I can do is I can plug this value in for each of the potential energies. Well, there we go. Charge times V final minus charge times V initial. And I now have an equation for the change in potential energy in terms of things that I know, in terms of my knowns. So my unknown is isolated, is put on one side of the equation, where my knowns are put on the other side of the equation. And so I could actually write down the change in potential energy. We know that the charge is an electron, so it's minus E times VF minus VI. So there's kind of the derived equation that now has my unknown and all my knowns on one side and all my knowns on the other side. Now I'm going to substitute in, and I can say, okay, we know what the charge is, we know what the final voltage is, we know what the initial voltage is. The electron charge, I'm going to list, if I list it right here just as E, you'll notice that E times V gives me the unit of electron volt, EV. So I can actually write that down as 150 minus 30 is 120, and my answer in the units of EV is 120 electron volts. That's almost, oh, sorry. It's almost too easy. Now, I could do the same thing in a different way. I could actually do it where I substitute in the actual value in SI units, in coulombs, in terms of electrons, then multiply times the change in voltage, and I solve that down, and I get minus 1.92 times 10 to minus 17 volts, you know, you see the units of volts times coulombs. Well, that seems like an odd unit. They're asking me for potential energy. I'm looking for one in terms of joules. Well, because coulombs are an SI unit, because volts are an SI unit, you multiply those two together, it turns out those happen to be exactly equal to joules. So that minus 1.92 times 10 to minus 17 joules is the value. Now, you'll notice that the ratio between these two is exactly the ratio between a single electron's charge and a coulomb. That also happens to be exactly the ratio. I could have done this right here and then taken it and I said, okay, 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules per electron volt, and I could have gotten what? Well, I could have gotten minus 1.92 times 10 to the minus 17 joules. So I, you know, this ratio is exactly the ratio. You notice that's the ratio of electron charge per coulomb. It's also the ratio of joules per electron volt. That's what happens to be the ratio. Works very easily both ways. And if I do the evaluation, the units, I get the units of electron volts or joules, that's right. Magnitude is a reasonable one, so I get an answer that's a reasonable thing to solve. Those are the kinds of problems, and really the way we want to you to step by step solve good problem. Let me give you a couple of clues on preparation for the test. The easiest way to do it is to actually go to pop out of this second. If I go to actually have on here Blackboard, go into our class in Blackboard, and it turns out there's a number of things you can look up. One of them is example problem solution. We've got some problems, and these are actually worked out problems. They don't happen to be from our current textbook. They're actually from an older textbook that we used several years ago. But they show, they're set up in a way, and I'll let you just choose one. Pull it up. They're PDF files. And it got printed. If you print them out, they print on one page the problem. On the next page, they'll print a solution, a way to solve that problem. And they don't show the principle. They don't show all the steps, but they do include basically all the steps that we do in our problem solutions. Now, how do you use those as a study aid? I'm going to recommend something that I have found to be very helpful, and hopefully you will as well. For each chapter, we've got probably 12 to 15 problems that are listed in this database. So that means you've probably got about 30 problems or so that are available to you that have a question and separately listed an answer. Don't simply go through and work and follow through the answer as it's been solved and try to figure out how they solved it. And use that as, like you would do the worked out problems in the chapter. That's not an effective way to use these. A very effective, because you've got lots of examples of those already in the chapters. But what I recommend you do is something different. Create for yourself practice tests. Take 3 or 4 or 5 of these problems, print them out, set the solution off to one side without looking at it. Set the test sheet off to another side. So now you have a test that's made up of 5 sheets of paper with the questions only listed on them and nothing else. See how, and then give yourself an hour, sit down and work through that test. You've created for yourself a practice test. Then go back. Once you have spent that hour trying all you could based on your previous study and all of your working through problems, can you do this blank paper test? Can I solve the problems? Go back and grade yourself on that test. What do you learn from the problems you got right? You probably have those concepts down pretty well. What do you learn from the problems you got wrong? Quite a bit more. Because you learn what are the focused areas of study you can use back in the chapter and end of chapter problems to study for the test more effectively. Hopefully that will be a more effective study aid for you than simply going through and looking through how they've solved the problem. Because if you stretch your mental muscles first and then test your understanding of the material, that's a more effective study aid. Any questions? And we had one more problem, and I'll see if we can do this one. Problem 8 out of the current web assignment. Let's see if we can look at that and see if we understand it. It says, in Rutherford's famous scattering experiment that led to planetary model of the atom, alpha particles, they gave the charge, they gave the mass, were fired toward gold nuclei with a charge of plus 79 electron volts. An alpha particle, initially very far from the gold nucleus, is fired at this number of meters per second toward the nucleus, as figured below. How close does the alpha particle get to the nucleus before turning around, assuming that the gold nucleus remains stationary? And they actually show us a little picture of this. So it says, okay, how far does it get before it turns around and comes to a stop and turns around? How do you solve that problem? If we were to go back and solve it, how would you attack that problem? So let's put that up on one screen. And what are the steps you'd use to solve through that problem? It's the easiest way to do it. You've got a blank sheet of paper. See if I can solve that problem together. What is the principle? So if I were to write down the very first thing, what is the principle of physics that you use to solve that problem? What is the underlying science that helps you understand that? What is it? Kinetic energy and potential energy. I'm going to write it down as conservation of energy. Okay? So, same thing. So that means that the change in potential energy plus the change in kinetic energy is equal to zero. Or I could have written it down, the potential energy initially plus the kinetic energy initially is equal to the potential energy final plus the kinetic energy final, right? Those are different ways of writing down conservation of energy. We know that when it, and we can do our little drawing here, we've got a charge plus 2e. We get another charge of plus 79e. And we know what, we can look at a before, or we look at the initial, and final. What are the two cases? We know what the initial velocity is. What does it say? It says the initial velocity is 1.7 times 10 to the 7th meters per second. So 1 equals 1.7 times 10 to the 7th times 10 plus 7 meters per second. Okay, so that's the initial velocity. Finally, you reach a point where the final velocity comes to a stop right next to it, and it's going to turn around and go back. So the final velocity is zero. We know what the charges are. We know what the masses are. What's the change in potential energy? The change in potential energy, and in fact, we should write this as, what are our knowns? Our knowns, Q1 is equal to Q1 equals 2E plus 2E. Q2 is equal to plus 79E. If we want to find out what Q2 is going to create an electric potential around it, and so what we're going to do is, when it's infinitely far away, we want to solve for the potential energy. So we know what the initial distance is. R initially is going to be infinitely far away. R final, where it comes to a stop, that's going to be our unknown. So there's our unknown. And we know what our initial and final velocities are. We should add to that, we know what the mass of one is. It's going to be the mass of the alpha particle, which they give to us. So that's given. The mass of two, I think they give that to us as well. Actually, they don't give that to us because that doesn't move. They don't claim that doesn't move, so that's not needed. How do you solve the problem? You want to solve it by creating an equation. You need an equation for the change in potential energy. We know what the equations for change in kinetic energy are of the moving alpha particle. How do you solve it? Well, that's going to be our first part of our isolating the unknown. You want to write down the potential energy for the initial condition and the final condition. So, isolate the unknown. Well, that means we want to write down this equation. Isolate the unknown, you're going to write down the equation for potential energy, change in potential energy. So what is the potential energy equation? The potential energy, electric potential energy for a charge next to another charge is going to be equal to K Q1 Q2 over R, right? So that means if I were to write down the change in potential energy, I'm going to write down the potential energy of the final position minus the potential energy of the initial position. So I can see that I've got those two. Now I can write those each in terms of that equation. So I can write down the change in potential energy equals K Q1 Q2 over R final minus K Q1 Q2 over R initial. Okay? Where R initial, I know that it's, they treat it, let's see how they, the way they say it. They say, fire toward the nucleus with a charge, the alpha particle initially very far from the gold nucleus. That's the very far from the gold nucleus is infinitely far away. If I put infinity in here, that means that goes to zero. So my change in potential energy really is only in terms of the final position. There you go, only in terms of the final position. Now I can write down the change in kinetic energy is equal to what? Well, it's equal to the kinetic energy final minus the kinetic energy initial. Well, we can write that down as equal to 1/2 m of the alpha particle v final squared minus 1/2 m of the alpha particle v initial squared. Well, it turns out that we also have written down up here what the final velocity is when the particle turns around. That happens to be zero. So that means that the kinetic energy here is this kinetic energy. And so we can write down the potential energy and change in potential energy plus change in kinetic energy. Delta PE plus delta KE. Remember, that's our equation from over the top. Conservation of energy is going to be equal to K Q1 Q2 over RF minus 1/2 the mass of the alpha particle V initial squared. Now, how many of those constants do you have in the problem? Well, we've been given the initial velocity, we've been given the mass of the alpha particle, we've been given both of the charges, we know the constant. We need to just simply take that, that happens to equal zero, take this equation and rearrange it to solve for the unknown RF, the final radius. Again, we're using concepts that we've learned over the course of a couple of semesters. And I could go and do that if you want me to. K, Q, 1, Q, 2 over RF is equal to 1/2 M alpha V I squared. Now I can take this and divide, take this and bring it up. And so I get K Q1 Q2 over 1/2 M alpha V initial squared is equal to RF. Now, again, there's my derived equation. I guess I don't want to use that as my starting point, but that is what I've obtained because I started out in the very beginning with conservation of energy. Now that's what I plug my numbers into and solve. If you do the process carefully, and you include all the information you need, you should do pretty well. Thanks, I will see you on Friday. Bring a calculator, bring a pencil, and you really don't need to bring much else. I will see you Friday.